Hi, welcome to New Books and Literary Studies on the New Books Network. My name is Kathleen DeGuzman, a co-host on the channel. Today, I will be talking to Latha Reddy. Latha is assistant professor in the English department at Howard University in Washington, D.C., where she teaches classes on British and Anglophone colonial and postcolonial literatures. She is also the author of a new book titled British Empire and the Literature of Rebellion, Revolting Bodies, Laboring Subjects, published by Palgrave Macmillan. Thank you, Latha, for joining me today to talk about your new book.
Thank you for having me.
I thought we'd get started by asking you to describe how you came to this project.
Sure. So this new book actually extends and expands my initial interest in 19th century British imperialism. So most of my earlier work focused on English language texts, especially poetic productions by South Asians during the 19th and early 20th centuries. And through that, I actually became interested in the Sepoy Rebellion of 1857, which was a constitutive event for the British Empire in that region. And in my research on the rebellion, I noticed a number of references to discussions of rebellions that took place the following decade in the 1860s in Jamaica and Ireland. Mm-hmm. So I began to research those two rebellions, the Moran Bay Rebellion of 1865 in Jamaica, and then the Fenian Rebellion of 1867 in Ireland. And I realized that there were striking parallels among these three sort of roughly contemporaneous rebellions. They were separated only by a decade. And that these rebellions in the 1950s and 60s were constitutively different from any of the revolts against British authority that had come before this period. So I set out to understand why that's the case.
Right. So your book examines three very different colonies. India was Britain's largest colony and also linked for so long to the East India Company, which mm-hmm. was sort of, a weird mix between being a corporation and also a militarized force. And you also look at Jamaica, which is in the Caribbean, and as a colony was propelled by the institution of slavery and forcibly imported labor from Africa. Finally, Ireland is known as Britain's internal colony. So what unites these three places aside from their link to Britain in your book and these rebellions?
I think oftentimes these colonies are studied separately. Mm-hmm. And I was interested in a comparative focus because these rebellions were happening roughly around the same time, and the discourses surrounding the rebellions took on some striking parallels, I realized that what was at stake in each of these three colonies necessitated a sort of comparative approach was the idea that they were revolting against a larger sort of structural transformation in British colonial or British imperialism. And so this larger structural transformation was the incursion of British imperial industrial capitalism into the colonies. And so for me, this allows for an exploration of some of the similarities between the three colonies, despite the very different ways in which they were governed, despite the very different historical context of each of the three colonies, and despite, in some cases, the very different trajectories that they would take in terms of later national independence and quote-unquote evolution into the post-colonial state.
Right. And I mean, while reading your chapter on the Sepoy Rebellion, for example, I was struck by how, one could even draw parallels to what happened to Haiti after the Haitian Revolution and how, the new nation of Haiti was forced to pay reparations to France for the, mm-hmm. the lost sugar plantations. And when you brought up how there was also a relationship of debt after the 1857 rebellion that made me think of, what could possibly happen if we expand, our comparative focus even beyond the British Empire.
Right, exactly. I think we can see parallels in a number of cases in terms of imperialist imperialist or neo-imperialist rule, whether by Britain or other European countries or the United States. I think some of the after effects or the legacies of imperial capitalism are very similar in all of these colonies.
Right, right. So I want to dig into, I guess, the actual book a little bit more. So could you tell us more about the significance of the book's title, particularly the part after the colon, Revolting Bodies, Laboring Subjects? Your introduction, for example, digs into how the term revolting means more than one thing for your argument.
The subtitle is actually, I think, where I locate the heart of the book. Like you said, this idea of revolting is really important for the book itself. So in my work, what I came to see was that these three rebellions, which were invariably read as proto-nationalist uprisings by nationalist elites in India, Jamaica, and Ireland during the late 19th and well into the 20th centuries, was actually taking place, like I mentioned, during a crucial historical juncture. So this historical juncture was when British industrial capital, like I said, was making incursions into the colonies in search of new sources of wage labor. So in light of this, these rebellions, or I came to see these rebellions as not necessarily nationalist per se, but as flashpoints for organized resistance by the colonized against British imperial capitalism, especially in British imperial capitalism's attempts to transform the oppressed colonized worker into a laboring subject. And by laboring subject, I mean a subject that's produced by his or her role as a wage earner or essentially as a source of labor power for capitalist accumulation. So the subtitle of the book, Revolting Bodies, Laboring Subjects, is really important for me because it points for me to the ways in which the revolting body of the colonies was reacting against the push to reconfigure him or her as a laboring subject for British imperial capitalism. And so I read revolting throughout the book as a verb, this idea of resistance, among the colonized against colonial rule, especially imperial capitalist transfigurations of colonial subjects into laboring subjects. But I also read revolt here as an adjective, as inspiring disgust among the British due to differences of race, religion, culture, etc. So for me, the revolting bodies here are significant because colonized bodies are not only read as disgusting or other by British imperialist capitalist discourse, but they inspire fear because of the possibility of resistance that they present as well.
Right, right. And to dig into the topic of terms a little bit more, I mean, rebellion, uprising, what are the stakes of naming resistance as such, particularly when reflecting on the past? One text you examine in relation to the Sepoy Rebellion, for example, is a 1909 text that identifies the rebellion as the Indian War of Independence.
Yeah, this text is really interesting because Savarkar's text is one of one of the earliest English language texts to deal with the rebellion and to cast it in these proto-nationalist terms. And in doing so, he radically revises British imperial discourse, which had previously cast the rebellion as a mutiny. In historical accounts, even today, the Sepoy rebellion is often termed the Sepoy mutiny. Mm-hmm. And obviously, I think there's a distinction between calling an event a mutiny versus calling an event a rebellion. So mutiny implies a disregard for legitimate authority, whereas a rebellion, I think, recasts that and tries to understand it as a legitimate uprising against illegitimate authority. And so Savarkar's text is also complicated for various reasons, you know, because even as he's trying to recast imperialist discourse and trying to see the rebellion in proto-nationalist terms, he also is very invested in transforming the Indian rebel into sort of a proper revolutionary subject. And this proper revolutionary subject is to eventually become a proper nationalist subject. And so, you know, he's also has sort of his own investments in constructing an Indian nation that is, as you know, he would write in later accounts based on, you know, very defined terms, for example, you know, as a Hindu nation. And so it's a complicated response, but it's also a very sort of radical rewriting of British historiography on the event.
That, I mean, hearing you elaborate a little bit more on that 1909 text, the Indian War of Independence, actually, for me, brings up a question about your archive. So these rebellions, you know, they generated so much writing, both when they happened and afterward as well. So with that proliferation of text available, what guided your approach to these archives for these three different rebellions?
Yeah, it was very difficult to narrow text down. As I started reading, there were so many things that so much writing surrounding each of the three rebellions, so much writing about the rebellions, so much writing related to or discussing the rebellions from a later historical standpoint, that it took sort of a great deal of effort for me to cull down the text that I wanted to look at, just because everything was so interesting. when I was attempting to sort of understand a way to organize my discussions on the rebellions around this issue of the transformation of the colonial body or the revolting body into a laboring subject, I sort of focused on this idea of the concept metaphor. So I organized each chapter, and each of the three main chapters focuses on one of the three rebellions around a central concept metaphor. So essentially a concept metaphor, which I draw from Derrida's discussion in White Mythologies, is sort of a trope that produces the abstract idea it's meant to explain in the process of explaining it itself. So, for example, the first chapter on the Sepoy Rebellion is organized around the concept metaphor of the machine and its and everything that's associated with the machine. So ideas of rationality, of regularity, science, progress, civilization, industry, capitalist development, et cetera, et cetera. So this concept metaphor of the machine was used in discourses about Indian labor at the time and, you know, up until now. It was also used in discourses about the Indian colonial state and the British technologies that were introduced to India at the time. And in that process, they also helped produce the idea of the Indian laborer as shaped by 18th century mechanical philosophy. So this idea of the mind-body divide, they helped produce this idea of the colonial state as a regulated structure that was powered by the army and powered by a bureaucracy. And it also helped produce various colonial technologies in the form of railways and telegraphs and prisons and guns, which were introduced to India in the mid-19th century. And the idea that these technologies were rationalized and regularized and represented civilizational progress that the British were bringing to India. And in this way, this concept metaphor of the machine also fundamentally, because it was present at the time in discourses about India, also ends up fundamentally shaping discourses about the Sepoy Rebellion itself. So the rebels, for example, the first round of rebels in the Sepoy Rebellion were sepoys in the employ of the British Army, were often cast as revolting due to racial and religious differences. But the reason for the rebellion that was often given in British historical accounts was that the animal fat used to grease the cartridges used by the sepoys violated indigenous religious injunctions. Mm-hmm. So in these British accounts then, you know, rather than changes to the positions of the sepoys themselves, you know, economic conditions for the peasants supporting them, land grabbing by the British, you know, of Indian leaders supporting the rebellion, British historical accounts focus on this idea of the cartridge as greased by animal fat as the primary motivator for rebellion. And so this allows them to cast the Indian rebels as irrational, atavistic, you know, especially in their destruction of property, you know, because the rebels were destroying telegraph lines and railways, you know, had requisitioned arms. And so their use of technology, rather than showing their own use, their own rationality, was then cast by the British as irrational, as sort of a civilizational backwardness. Because of this concept metaphor, I noticed that within indigenous accounts of the rebellions by Indians sympathetic to the rebels and writing about the rebellion, the onus was on them to recast the rebellion as either a rational act to show how the machinery of the state is less far-reaching than it's believed to be, or to show how the retribution enacted by the British in the aftermath of the rebellion was itself irrational because it was ill-considered and depended more on passion rather than any notion of justice or fair play. And so this idea of the concept metaphor structures each of the chapters. So for the chapter on the Sepoy Rebellion in India, the concept metaphor of the machine structures the text that I looked at. Insofar as this idea comes up in the text sort of deal with this idea and provide a sort of a larger language in which to look at, you know, issues surrounding the Sepoy Rebellion and the issues surrounding the Sepoy Rebellion. In the chapter on Jamaica, the concept metaphor that I focus on is that of the spirit. And then in Ireland, the concept metaphor that I focus on is that of the cell form. And so these concept metaphors were sort of a crucial organizing strategy for the book. Sort of helped me see some of the larger trends and themes and issues that were at stake for each of these individual rebellions, as well as the historical context surrounding each of those individual rebellions.
So you already kind of elaborated on the significance of the concept metaphor of the machine in your discussion of India. So could you go ahead and also talk a little bit about the significance of, you know, the spirit in the Jamaica chapter and of the cell when you get to the Fenian Rebellion?
So the second chapter on the Morant Bay Rebellion in Jamaica is organized around the concept metaphor of the spirit. So insofar as spirit-based Afro-Caribbean syncretic religions during that time played a crucial role in colonized resistance against this new regime of biopower, which I claim that British imperial capitalism is forwarding in all of its colonies during this period. This idea of the spirit is important because it comes out of Jamaican resistance itself. There was a discussion, you know, in the text. There's a lot of discussion in the historical text about two of the leaders, one of the leaders of the Morant Bay Rebellion, Paul Bogle, hosting a feasting ritual, for example, before the rebellion itself, a spirit feasting ritual before the rebellion itself. In addition, the recent event of the Haitian Revolution, which we had talked about earlier, acted as a haunting presence in both imperialist and anti-imperialist understanding of the Morant Bay Rebellion and of rebellion generally, more generally in the Caribbean. So as I try to show, the Haitian Rebellion is this constant sort of ghostly presence for all discussions of rebellion within the region at that time. And well after that time as well. And then lastly, the labor rebellions of the 1930s, which are read by some historians as a successor to the Morant Bay Rebellion, represent sort of a spirit of an age. And so I saw this idea of the spirit as really central to the Marianne Bay Rebellion and discussions about some of the issues that arose during the Marianne Bay Rebellion, you know, which in some ways can be read essentially as a form of a labor rebellion, also a rebellion against a rebellion focused on land. The spirit becomes a sort of grounding idea for this chapter. And the third chapter on the Fenian Rebellion in Ireland is organized around the concept metaphor of the cell. So contemporary discussions of the biological cell sort of flourished in the 19th century with all these discoveries in sort of the way the cell works. This idea of the biological cell influenced a lot of discussions of Irish overpopulation, for example. So not only had the Great Famine occurred within the lifetime of most of the Fenians who took part in the Fenian Rebellion, but the destruction wrought by the Great Famine was often tied by some of the more radical Irish commentators that I looked at the time to British imperial policies on food, land, and the poor. The biological cell was also used to explain Irish ethnic or racial and religious differences, right? The fact that they were seen as less than white or not quite white, mm-hmm. And obviously the fact that they were also Catholic. So that otherness, you know, in turn supposedly explained the Irish as criminals, inhabitants, you know, of prison cells or terrorists, right? Participants in terrorist cells or networks. And so this recourse to biology and eugenics to explain sort of Irish difference in criminality and to justify the exploitation of their labor and land was sort of a constant refrain in the text from that period. And then lastly, the fact that Marx sort of very famously in the first volume of Capital analogizes the most fundamental unit of capitalist economy, the commodity form, to a cell, I think is really revealing in a lot of ways. Since industrial capitalism, you know, of course, relies on the transformation of certain groups of people like the poor or the colonized or the racialized and gendered other into biological specimens who then are sort of pressed into service as labor power. So in other words, revolting bodies who are transfigured into laboring or who are attempted to be transfigured into laboring subjects. And so those are the three concept metaphors that sort of organize each of the rebellions in each of the chapters in the book.
Yeah, I think each one is such a rich organizing device for, you know, drawing out the parallels between these rebellions that, you know, as you said at the outset, usually aren't put in conversation with one another. And another organizing device throughout the entire book is something that you mentioned at the outset of the response that you gave me just now, and that is the term biopower. So mm-hmm. biopower is a key idea throughout the book. And at the same time, the colonized context that you examine suggests a need to slightly depart from the work of central figures in biopower, such as, you know, writing by Foucault or Agamben. So what does biopower therefore mean for your book, particularly as wielded by the colonized or by the revolting bodies?
That's biopower. Is really important, as you said, is really important for the book because I see, this new structural transformation that's happening in British imperialism at the time as driven by a new regime of biopower. And so I read biopower here more generally as an investment in control over the life of the species, as Foucault talks about, and the disciplining of the individual body by the state, but also by corporations or by capital inclusion with the state. And so, as you said, discussions of the colonies are often left outside of theoretical discussions of biopower. And so it became important to me to sort of think through the ways in which biopower becomes transformed or transfigured in its application to colonial subjects. And so in order to understand that, I sort of focus on some key theoretical texts by thinkers of biopolitics in each of the chapters. And so the chapter on the Fenian Rebellion in Ireland, for example, I look at the work of Roberto Esposito in BIOS on this idea of immunity and immunization. And I think about the ways in which this idea of immunization can be applied to an internal colony, as Ireland is, right? So his contention that a virus needs to be both taken into a body, but then also ejected from it, I think it serves as a really useful metaphor for an internal colony, but then also must be sort of rethought to sort of to apply to that internal colony. And so the way in which I think about it is that this idea of immunization sort of not only is the way for the British Empire to protect itself against foreign threats, right, against Irish terrorists, for example, but essentially at the end, it also serves as a way to contract the British imperial state inadvertently. So by ejecting Irish terrorists, for example, by sending them off to exile in Australia or the US, it's also not only contracting its population, but it also actively contracts the sort of the scope of the state itself, right? It would lose Ireland as a colony in the 1920s, and then Northern Ireland with the peace sharing agreement in 1998. So Esposito's discussion, while I found it very fruitful, I think sort of needs some thinking through in its application to a colonial context. And in this way, I saw that in each of my understandings of biopower or the theories of biopower in a colonial context for each of the three chapters.
I'd like to continue talking about biopower, but shifting a little bit more to your conclusion, which brings us from the 19th century to the 20th century. And you end the book by inviting us to think of financial conditions such as debt and austerity as tools of biopower in our present moment. And I love how you continue the parallels between India, Jamaica, and Ireland in your conclusion by pointing out how all three of those places were crippled by loans from the IMF and the World Bank. So what does or what can rebellion or a revolting body look like today with these adapted forms of biopower?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the conclusion, I think, is sort of my attempt to address everything, sort of to continue the discussion on the three rebellions, but also address sort of a glaring absence from the body of the book from the three chapters, which is essentially sort of the absence of women as historical agents and as rebels. And unfortunately, much of the discussion or the text on the rebellions themselves either foreclose women's role within them or neglect a discussion of them or just erase them altogether. And I think, you know, future work would very productively sort of try to reinsert them into that historical narrative. Since I wasn't able to address sort of women's roles there, I was interested in thinking through the ways in which women were also as historical subjects or as historical agents were also conditioned by these very things which I saw going on in the 19th century, and they're conditioned by them in the 20th and 21st centuries in similar but different ways. So in the conclusion, I aim to show how these 19th century forms of resistance against the transformation of revolting bodies into laboring subjects continues today in a different form under neoliberalism, rather than under industrial capitalism, as had been the case in the 19th century. And I do so through the concept metaphor in the conclusion of the reproductive disposable woman. And so the reproductive disposable woman, I contend, is sort of the new laboring subject of our neo or maybe even post-neoliberal era. And so in this chapter, I draw from Marxist feminist thought, and I'm sort of interested in even newer and more invasive regimes of biopower. So these newer and more invasive regimes of biopower, of course, impose themselves in the form of austerity measures, you know, as you mentioned before, in the form of loans to the state itself, the post-colonial state by the World Bank or the IMF. And the way in which those loans are, and the restructuring of the post-colonial economy affect both the economy at a macroeconomic level, but also individuals' own lives and livelihoods through austerity measures. And so I talk about, or I mentioned farmer suicides, for example, in India within the last few decades, which have, you know, been linked to the rise of agribusiness and the lack of the forced use of genetically modified seeds and the pressure placed upon farmers who don't have the support networks to sort of make a living from the land anymore. But I'm also interested in the ways in which these new invasive regimes of biopower act not only in terms of austerity, but also in terms of women's lives more specifically, and so that are invested in women's reproductive roles. And so I look here at biopower in terms of biological reproduction, especially since India in the post-colonial era has been sort of one of the premier places for foreign surrogacy. And so women who essentially poor women have been paid to act as surrogates for foreign people looking for offspring. And so this last chapter is interested in sort of the different forms that biopower now takes, you know, in terms of austerity measures in the post-colonial state, but also in terms of sort of reproduction and the reproductive capacities or the reproductive pressures placed on women.
As, so on the note of new horizons for future work, I'd like to begin wrapping up our conversation by asking you to talk a little bit about what you're working on now.
Sure. So my new project actually draws from this or is an extension in some ways, or maybe more a continuation and expansion on some of the concerns that animated my discussion in the conclusion to Revolting Bodies, Laboring Subjects. So the conclusion, as I said, is interested in women's reproduction, especially as it plays out under a new regime of biopower. You know, in that conclusion, I looked at a speculative fiction play that, you know, sort of examines, you know, women's, you know, women being harvested for their reproductive abilities. So my new project sort of is, you know, takes that as a springboard. And this new project, which is sort of tentatively titled Reproductive Value, a term that's used in demography studies to indicate a woman's future contribution to the population, focuses on the question of value as it's related to the appropriation of women's labor, both social and biological, so their reproductive labor in both senses, and its relationship to environmental change, or actually what we've come to think of recently as environmental collapse. And by the environment, I mean sort of the built environment, but also what we think of as the quote-unquote natural environment. It's sort of still at the formative stages, but I plan to sort of draw on a variety of texts, short stories, novels, poetry, plays, prints about female IRA agents during the Troubles in Northern Ireland, African women transported on the slave ship, the Zong, which was heading to the Caribbean during the 1780s and which became infamous for the massacre of well over 100 slaves en route.
Right.
Lower caste and class Indian women before and during the Declaration of Emergency Law in 1978 and 1975 and the forced sterilization campaigns during that era. And then also the missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls in the U.S. and Canada that have sort of been sort of subjects of investigation by the Canadian government recently. So I'm interested in all of these sort of historical contexts and the texts produced in those contexts and about those contexts to think through this idea of sort of women and reproduction and value sort of related to environmental change. So it's sort of at a very tentative stage right now, but that's where the new project is headed.
Awesome. That sounds great. I mean, I love how you're looking not only at different historical contexts, but also, you know, continuing the work that you've done in the book we're talking about today in terms of looking at multiple geographic contexts.
Yeah, it should be exciting. I'm looking forward to working on it.
Awesome. Can't wait. So we've been talking about the book British Empire and the Literature of Rebellion, Revolting Bodies, Laboring Subjects. Thank you, Latha, for such a great conversation about your work.
Thank you so much.